Two more terrible murders are now added to the long list of East End tragedies, which have filled London with horror and alarm. The audacity and cunning of the criminal is certainly unparalleled. Before the victim has time to utter a cry, one swift, deep stroke descends, and all is over, except the horrible work of mutilating the lifeless body. Once round a corner into a main thoroughfare, the miscreant is safe from arrest, for he can keep a sufficient distance from the lamps to hinder any recognition of blood marks on his clothing. The Echo, 1st of October, 1888. You are now entering London's East End to experience the Autumn of Terror. Please note that this episode contains adult themes and descriptions of violent crimes, which may not be suitable for all audiences. The use of the term prostitution is in no way intended to cause offence, but it will be used in this series for historical accuracy, as that is what it was referred to back then. Primary sources have been used as much as possible. This series has been created with the utmost respect for the victims in mind.
Hello and welcome back to 1888. This is Prasher's Murder Map. Thank you for joining me for episode 5 of this Jack the Ripper mini-series. Right at the peak of the Autumn of Terror, when two women were killed on the same night, less than an hour apart. Last time we headed to the Ten Bells pub in the heart of Whitechapel to tell the story of Liz Stride, whose blood ran in red rivulets into the street, when her throat was cut from ear to ear at Duffield's Yard on Sunday 30th of September 1888. Less than an hour later, and under a mile from the scene of the Stride killing, Catherine Eddowes was found dead in Mitre Square, subjected to the most horrific mutilation yet. Rather than going straight to the scene, I'm going to change things up for this episode and talk about Eddowes and her life first, before explaining how she met her tragic demise. In a case like this, it's easy to become immersed in the sensational, gory details. So let's take a step back and a change of pace as we remember that every one of these women was an individual who deserves to be remembered in her own right, and not just as victims of arguably the most infamous serial killer in history. Catherine Eddowes was born on April the 14th, 1842, in Wolverhampton, in the Midlands of England, to Mother Catherine and Father George, who was a tinplate worker. She was the sixth of 12 children, but in those days such large families were not uncommon, and a high infant mortality rate, especially among the poor, meant that parents didn't expect every baby to survive. In fact, three of the Eddowes children died young. In 1843, the family decided to move to London, so they walked all the way, more than 120 miles, When Catherine was just 13, her mother died, and 2 years later her father followed. Orphaned and with no source of income, in an unfriendly city, she made her way back to Wolverhampton to stay with her aunt. In 1862, she was caught stealing from an employer and ran away to live with an uncle in the nearby city of Birmingham, where she started working as a tray polisher before going back to Wolverhampton to live with her grandfather. Eventually, she met partner Thomas Conway, a street hawker who sold cheap books and gallows ballads, and they ended up back in London. Gallows ballads were exactly what they sound like, songs or poems hastily written and printed overnight about criminals who were due to hang the next day, then sold to the public literally at the foot of the gallows. This happened elsewhere in the country too. Here's one verse from a ballad written about a Portsmouth murder in 1829.
A barbarous, foul and horrid deed I shortly shall recite, which did occur in Portsmouth town upon a Sunday night. An aged man of 80 years, his housekeeper likewise, were there most basely murdered by a monster in disguise. All in the night, so dark and drear, his entrance he obtained, and with a deadly hammer he beat out the old man's brains. His throat he cut from ear to ear, most horrible to view, and streams of crimson blood did flow the bedroom through and through.
This sort of thing would probably disparagingly be called doggerel these days, but back then it was what passed as entertainment, and the public lapped it up. Eddowes and Conway even wrote one based on the execution of Catherine's cousin, who was hanged in 1866. The pair lived a nomadic lifestyle, and Catherine sometimes claimed to be married to Thomas Conway, but there's no evidence a ceremony ever took place. Nonetheless, the 5-foot-tall, hazel-eyed and auburn-haired Kate, as she was often known, had his initials tattooed in blue ink on her forearm. Conway didn't earn much, but he drew a regular pension from his soldiering days. They had 3 children, Anne, Thomas and Alfred, and they lived at 71 Lower Gower Street in Chelsea, one of the better parts of London. Sadly, by 1881 the couple had split, probably due to Catherine's heavy drinking, which was at odds with Conway, as he was a teetotaler. She took her daughter Anne, while Thomas took their 2 sons, Alfred and Thomas Jr. Catherine found her way to the East End and began living with a man named John Kelly in Spitalfields, mostly staying at Cooney's lodging house in Flower and Dean Street, which you might remember was one of the worst, most criminal streets in the area, a stark contrast to her earlier life in Chelsea. Anne got married and moved away to avoid Catherine scrounging money from her, telling her mother she wanted nothing to do with her. Although the deputy at Cooney's lodging house said that Eddowes was not often in drink and was a very jolly woman, often singing, she did appear at the Thames Police Court for being drunk and disorderly. The deputy also said she wasn't in the habit of walking the streets, and he'd never known her to be intimate with anyone other than John Kelly. Kelly himself admitted that although Catherine sometimes drank to excess, he had no knowledge of her ever going on the streets to earn money. This is interesting because most people believe that all Jack the Ripper's victims were prostitutes, but there doesn't appear to be much evidence that Eddowes was. A book about the victims by Hallie Rubenhold, The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper, has tried to take a closer look at what the victims were really like, but her research has been heavily criticised by serious ripperologists. She claims that at least 3 of the women were unlikely to have been sex workers. In Eddowes' case, I agree, but I think Rubenhold's assertions should be treated with caution. I believe that by trying so hard to prove that the victims weren't prostitutes and were more educated and accomplished than they really were, she's doing the opposite of what she probably intended. She's giving the impression that in her eyes, these women were not good enough as they were, unless history was revised. If her goal was to shine a light on their individual personalities and prove their worth as people, not just written off by history as poverty-stricken drunks, then maybe she should have focused on the social and economic inequalities of the time that led them to that point, rather than trying to suggest their lives weren't really like that. In any case, I applaud the efforts of those who tell the story of the victims, but we have to remember there are many books out there, and the reliability of the research should be questioned before choosing one to rely on. Every year, Kelly and Eddowes went hop picking in Kent, something many poor families from London look forward to. Even as late as the 1950s, people would travel to hop farms in the neighbouring county for a working holiday, helping farmers to pick hops, which are flowers used for making beer. Those who could afford a train ticket could cover the 35 miles or so in style, but others had to make do with walking. Not only would they enjoy fresh, healthy air in the countryside, but on a good year, they could earn enough money to keep them going over the harsh winter months. The year of Eddowes's death, she and Kelly had not had a good hopping season, and the wages were low, so they decided to leave early and walk home. They arrived in London on Thursday, September the 27th, just 3 days before Catherine would be viciously murdered. Without enough money for their Flower and Dean Street lodgings, they spent the night in the casual ward in the Shoe Lane workhouse. The next day, Kelly earned sixpence, but it wasn't enough to pay for a double room at Cooney's, so Catherine took tuppence and said she would try the casual ward again, and told Kelly to take fourpence to get a single bed at the lodging house. The superintendent of the casual ward knew Kate well and allegedly had a foreboding conversation with her that night.
"Haven't seen you for a while, Kate. Where you been?"
"I've been hopping in the country, but we didn't earn very much, so we hoofed it home. Anyway, I'm going to earn the reward offered for the apprehension of the Whitechapel murderer. I think I know him."
"Well, you ought to be careful he don't murder you at all."
"No fear of that."
This makes for a striking tale, but there's no corroborating evidence for this story, so it should be taken with a grain of salt. At 8 a.m. on Saturday 29th of September, Kate Eddowes met up with John Kelly at Cooney's lodging house. They were still desperate for money, so they pawned a pair of boots they'd bought in Kent for 2 shillings and 6p, which bought them breakfast, tea and sugar. They spent the rest of the morning together, then parted in Houndsditch around 2 p.m. Eddowes told Kelly she was going to look for her daughter to ask for money. Kelly warned her to be careful.
"Don't forget there's a murderer about, Kate."
"Don't you fear for me. I shall take care of myself and I shan't fall into his hands."
It turned out that John Kelly's fears were well-founded and he never did get to find out whether Catherine spoke to her daughter or not. In fact, most of the day remained unaccounted for until she was spotted at 8:30 p.m. on the Aldgate High Street sleeping rough. She smelt of alcohol and had attracted a crowd of onlookers. PC Lewis Robinson of the City Police asked if anyone knew who she was or where she lived, but nobody did. She tried to stand but staggered, so Robinson called for help from PC Simmons, and they took her to Bishopsgate Police Station, putting her in a cell to sleep it off. They checked on her regularly, and by 9 p.m. she was asleep. As Eddowes was led into the station, she would immediately have noticed the almost palpable smell of carbolic soap, used to clean the tiled walls and floors, designed for easy mopping if people were brought in bleeding or vomiting. The ceilings were tall, and the building was lit with mounted gas lamps, illuminating the long wooden reception desk. In each room was a small fireplace to keep the place warm for officers completing paperwork, and there would be a lamp room for keeping stock of bullseye lanterns and maintaining them, a parade room where bobbies would muster before going out on the beat, and in some of the more newly built stations, a telegraph room. If you're interested in the history of the British police in this time period, I'll be releasing a bonus episode on Patreon with more details about their training, the requirements for joining the force, and the equipment they carried. Just after midnight, Kate was heard singing softly. At 12:30 a.m, she called out to the police officers.
"Hey, when will I be released?"
"When you were capable of taking care of yourself."
"I can do that now."
"We'll see when the sergeant comes round."
At 12:55 a.m, the sergeant came by to see if any prisoners were fit to be released, and by now Kate was found to be sober. She'd refused to give her name when she was brought to the station earlier, and when asked again before her release, she called herself Mary Ann Kelly, which bizarrely was very similar to the name Mary Jane Kelly, who would become the Ripper's final canonical victim. This has given rise to some fantastic theories that the killer was choosing specific victims, but it's likely that she gave the surname Kelly because her partner was John Kelly, and she didn't want to give her real name. She left the station at around 1 a.m, speaking to PC George Hutt as she left.
"Ugh, what time is it?"
"Too late for you to get anything to drink."
"Oh, I shall get a damn fine hiding when I get home."
"And serve you right. You had no right to get drunk. This way, missus."
All right. Good night, old cock.
She didn't turn right out of the station towards Cooney's lodging house, instead turning left towards Houndsditch and Aldgate. Some have suggested she was heading to St. Botolph Church, also known as the Prostitutes' Church. According to local legend, police had an arrangement with the sex workers in the area, granting them amnesty so long as they confined themselves to the area just outside the church. Apparently, you would see a long line of prostitutes walking around and around outside it each night. There's no evidence that this story is true, but many did ply their trade in that area, as there was a lot of footfall. Wherever she was planning to go, neither Catherine Eddowes nor the police officer who released her had any idea that just 400 yards away in Mitre Square, she would become the next victim of the Whitechapel murderer. Mitre Square was a small, cobbled area with a passage to its north leading into St. James's Place and to the east a passage leading to St. Botolph Church, known as Church Passage. Even now, this alleyway is only 4 metres wide, but back in 1888, it measured just 1 metre across. There were three dim gas lamps, one in Mitre Square, one in the northeast corner, and one near Church Passage, each giving off a light no stronger than a modern fridge. The square was surrounded by tall warehouse buildings, including those belonging to Williams & Co., Horner & Son, and the famous Keeley & Tong tea merchant. There were only a few other buildings in Mitre Square. PC Richard Pierce of the City Police lived in one of the houses with his family, another house was empty, and the third was a picture framing shop. It's changed a lot since 1888, and the square cobbles, known as sets, have mostly been replaced, but the approximate shape of the square remains. Even now, with better lighting, it's an eerie place at night, which my wife and I noticed when we went on a Ripper tour several years ago, led by eminent Ripperologist and author Philip Hutchinson. By the way, don't forget, Philip will be kindly lending his voice acting talents to two characters in the next episode. At 1:40 a.m, PC James Harvey walked down Church Passage and peered into Mitre Square. He didn't see or hear anything unusual, so he didn't go any further in. Just 4 minutes later, PC Edward Watkins went into the square as part of his regular beat, which would involve checking that warehouses were secure and liaising with the night watchman there if necessary, who was a bit like a modern-day security guard.
Oh my God! Where's the night watchman? Hey, for God's sake, mate, come to my assistance.
Stop until I get my lamp. What's the matter?
Oh God, there's another woman been ripped to pieces.
It was 46-year-old Catherine Eddowes. George Morris, night watchman for tea merchants Keeley and Tong, was sweeping the floor when he heard the shout. He brought his lantern and followed PC Watkins to the corner of the square, illuminating the grotesque scene with a ghastly glow. When he saw the heart-stopping spectacle in front of him, he turned and ran up Mitre Square and into Aldgate, blowing his whistle to attract attention. He bumped into PC Harvey, who had passed by just a few minutes before but hadn't entered the square. Morris explained what had happened, although no doubt he struggled to find the words to describe the sickening reality of what he had seen. PC Harvey ran to Mitre Square, enlisting another constable, Holland, on his way, telling him to fetch a doctor. Dr. Sequeira lived just 2 minutes away and arrived on the scene shortly before 2 a.m. He was sure that the victim had only been dead for a few minutes and certainly no more than a quarter of an hour. City police surgeon Dr. Gordon Brown arrived shortly after. The wounds and mutilations inflicted on Eddowes' body were the worst anyone had seen yet. This is an extract from his post-mortem report.
The throat was cut across. The intestines were drawn out and placed over the right shoulder. A piece of about 2 feet was detached from the body and placed between the body and the left arm. The right ear was cut obliquely through. When we removed the body to the mortuary, a piece of the deceased's ear dropped from the clothing. The face was very much mutilated. There were cuts to both eyelids. There was a deep cut over the bridge of the nose, extending from the left border of the nasal bone down near the angle of the jaw on the right side of the cheek, going into the bone. The tip of the nose was detached. Another cut divided the upper lip and extended through the gum. There was on each side of the cheeks a cut which peeled up the skin, forming a triangular flap about 1.5 inches. The throat was cut across to the extent of 6 or 7 inches. The big muscle across the throat was divided through on the left side. The large vessels on the left side of the neck were severed. The larynx was severed below the vocal cords. The carotid artery had a fine hole opening. The internal jugular vein was opened. All these injuries were performed by a sharp-pointed knife of at least 6 inches long. The cause of death was hemorrhage from the left carotid artery. The death was immediate, and the mutilations were inflicted after death. The front walls of the abdomen were laid open. The liver was stabbed by a sharp instrument. There was a stab of about 1 inch on the left groin. The left kidney and the uterus were carefully taken out and removed.
Dr. Brown felt that the perpetrator must have had expert anatomical knowledge, although Dr. Sequeira and medical officer William Saunders disagreed, and at the inquest Dr. Brown was forced to admit that somebody used to cutting up animals could have done it. He did point out that the kidney was not easy to stumble upon unless you knew where it was. Making all the mutilations must have taken some time, at least 5 minutes, although this contradicts the view of George Baxter Phillips, as he thought that it would have taken at least 15 minutes to inflict the injuries on Annie Chapman, who was not mutilated as badly as Eddowes. But it could be argued that he was judging this based on his experience as a surgeon, who would be taking care to do the job correctly and not injure a living victim, whereas the killer had no need for caution and would have been filled with the frenzy of bloodlust and the need to escape. As Eddowes died instantly when her throat was cut, she would have been unable to make a noise, and as the mutilations were inflicted after death, there wouldn't necessarily have been much blood on the killer. What was so bizarre about all of this was the fact that nobody had heard anything, and Constables Watkins and Harvey hadn't seen anyone when they passed by. Watkins, who had 17 years' experience as a police officer, walked through Mitre Square every 15 minutes on his beat, so the killer had somehow committed his atrocities in a very narrow window and escaped detection by moments. This is one of the murders that has added to the mystique of Jack the Ripper, the image of a spectre who is swallowed up by the night, leaving no trace behind. Night watchman George Morris was certain he would have heard a cry or shout if there had been one. Unbelievably, he had been smoking his pipe just outside the door of the warehouse at the time of the murder.
Before being called, I had no occasion to go into the square. I did not go there between 1 and 2 o'clock, of that I'm certain. There was nothing unusual in my door being open and my being at work at so late an hour. I had not seen PC Watkins before during the night. I did not think my door had been ajar for more than 2 or 3 minutes when he knocked. It was awful. It looked as though she'd been cut up like a pig or any other animal you see in the market.
George Clapp, a caretaker at number 5 Mitre Street, didn't hear anything all night, even though the back of his house looked directly into Mitre Square. The first he heard of the murder was at around 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. Constable Richard Pearce of the City Police lived at number 3 Mitre Square, one of the only 2 private houses in the square. He went to bed at 12:20 on the night of the murder and heard no disturbance whatsoever until he was called at 2:20 after Edo's body was discovered. From his window, he could see the spot where she was found. How was it possible that so many people could have been in or around the square and yet heard nothing? It reminds me of the frustration of Hanbury Street when Albert Kadosh heard a thump against the fence. If he had looked over, he might have seen the face of Jack the Ripper. And yet again at Mitre Square, the killer had been almost supernaturally fortunate. PC Pierce, caretaker Clapp or night watchman Morris could have looked outside at any moment and witnessed a slaughter in progress. Just before 3 a.m, PC Alfred Long made a shocking discovery in Goulston Street, just 5 minutes away from the murder scene by foot. As he walked past a doorway leading to a staircase up to some homes called the Wentworth Model Dwellings, he noticed a piece of apron lying on the floor just inside the doorway. It was smeared with blood and fecal matter and looked like it had been used to wipe the blade of a knife. Yet when he'd passed by just 40 minutes before, he was sure it hadn't been there. The apron was confirmed to belong to Catherine Eddowes. Had the killer dropped it while fleeing the scene, on his way back to wherever he lived, the headquarters of hell? But the plot was about to thicken even more. As PC Long picked up the abandoned piece of bloody apron, he spotted something even more baffling. A message was scrawled in chalk on the door jamb above the apron saying, "The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing." This has become known among Ripperologists as the Goulston Street Graffito. Apparently it's only called graffiti if it's plural, just one piece is graffito. There has been much debate about this over the years, and nobody is entirely sure whether this is exactly what the message said or not, as it doesn't make much sense. There was a class of jurisdictions as the city police, in whose territory of just 1 square mile Catherine Eddowes was killed, wanted the writing to be photographed, but the Metropolitan Police, in whose territory Goulston Street fell, argued that that could mean waiting until it was light to get a decent picture. And by then, people would be awake and the message would be seen, something they wanted to avoid at all costs. Tensions between Jews and non-Jews were already at boiling point, so leaving a piece of anti-Semitic graffito on the wall was out of the question, and Goulston Street was a predominantly Jewish road. Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Charles Warren arrived on the scene, and as the doorway was officially on Met Police territory, his orders stood. The graffito was to be washed away immediately. Whether the police officers copied it down into their notebooks correctly before the chalk was washed off is still agonised over today. The word Jews had been given a curious spelling. J-U-W-E-S. This has fueled conspiracy theories about Freemasonry, which we won't go into here, but many still believe that Jack the Ripper deliberately wrote this cryptic statement as a mocking red herring to turn the police's attention to the Jewish community rather than on himself. Many others, including me, think it's more likely that the dropping of the apron under the graffito was just a coincidence. The writing on the brickwork was much smaller than is often imagined or shown in films, and it seems an unrealistically Machiavellian move for a killer of the time to think of writing something on the wall as a diversionary tactic. It would have been almost impossible to see what he was doing in the dark, and his priority would have been to ditch the apron as soon as possible and get off the street. Some people have suggested that as graffiti was quite common at the time, it's possible that a disgruntled customer of one of the Jewish shops in nearby Middlesex Street had written it in anger after a bad purchasing experience. After all, Saturday would have been market day. As for why the killer took Edo's apron with him at all, some suggest it was to wipe the blood off his hands and knife, and the reason he didn't do this at the scene was because he heard someone coming and didn't have time, so he grabbed it, cleaned himself up as best he could as he ran, then disposed of it in a quiet place. Alternatively, he could have used it to carry the kidney and uterus he'd removed from the body. But then, What did he do with the organs after he threw away the apron? Did he just carry it in his bare hands or put it in his pocket? There are many unanswered questions with this murder. As for what happened to the kidney afterwards, George Lusk, chairman of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, would find out a couple of weeks later when he received a nauseating package in the mail along with the now famous From Hell letter. I'm going to see if he'll come and speak to us and tell us what the letter said, so please wait here a moment and I'll see what I can do.
I've lost my key.
Feed me my bread. Oh, here's some lovely...
Hello, love. You look lost. Maybe I can help.
No, thank you. I'm just waiting for my aunt.
You sure? It's a bit rough round here. Perhaps you'd be better off coming with me.
Please, leave me alone. I don't wish to speak to you.
Well, well, aren't you the posh one?
I'll be on my way now. Good day to you.
Ah, to hell with you.
Hell would be too good for you, villainous rat bag.
Oi, come back here, you bloody...
Stop! Thief! Help! Police! He's got my purse!
Don't worry, madam, I'll catch him for you. Red ink.
Where's my red ink? Right, good news. I've got him with me now. So tell me, George, what was in the parcel? What did it look like?
Oh my God! It was awful! It was a 3-inch square cardboard box, and inside was a half-human kidney preserved in wine.
That must have been a terrible shock. And the letter?
I'll read it to you. Hold on. Here's what it said. From hell, Mr. Lusk. Sir, I send you half the kidney I took from one woman and preserved it for you. T'other piece I fried and ate. It was very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out if you only wait a while longer. Signed, Catch Me When You Can. Mr. Lusk, what do you think of that?
I can't imagine how you must have felt reading that, George. Thank you for your time.
Not at all, mate. Top of the morning to you.
A doctor examined the kidney sent to Lusk and found it was remarkably like the one taken from the victim, and whoever it had belonged to had suffered from Bright's disease, just like Edo's. This was an inflammation of the kidney, which would be called nephritis today. Although it was common, with many well-known people suffering from it, like the first wife of Theodore Roosevelt, the Birdman of Alcatraz, and Booker T. Washington, the chances of a hoaxer stumbling on an organ totally consistent with the victim in some kind of grave or mortuary-robbing escapade seemed slim. The handwriting and phrasing were vastly different from the Dear Boss letter, with the words barely legible and poorly spelt. This is another of the reasons why the From Hell letter is considered more likely to be from the real killer, whereas most researchers agree that Dear Boss came from a journalist seeking a scoop. The Lusk letter wasn't the only one received after the night of Stride and Edo's deaths. This became known as the Saucy Jackie postcard.
I was not codding, dear old boss, when I gave you the tip. You'll hear about Saucy Jackie's work tomorrow. Double event this time. Number one squealed a bit. Couldn't finish straight off. Ha! Not the time to get ears for police. Thanks for keeping last letter back till I got to work again. Jack the Ripper.
The writing was similar to the Dear Boss letter, so it's commonly believed that this also came from a journalist, especially in light of the more modern theory that Liz Stride was not a Ripper victim, and so it may not have been a double event at all. No clues were found at the crime scene, and police were still dumbfounded. The whole neighbourhood was searched, including lodging houses, with several men stopped in the streets, and a house-to-house inquiry in and around Mitre Square, but it turned up very little, although they did find some witnesses with interesting stories to tell. James Blenkinsop, a night watchman overlooking the roadworks in St James's Place behind Mitre Square, said a respectably dressed man had approached him on the night of the murder and asked if he'd seen a man and a woman pass through, to which he answered he had seen people but hadn't paid any attention to them. At 1:35 a.m, three men left the Imperial Club in Duke Street and were walking towards Aldgate High Street in the rain. They were commercial cigarette trader Joseph Lavender, butcher Joseph Hyam Levy, and furniture dealer Harry Harris. They saw Catherine Eddowes talking to a man near Church Passage, one of the narrow alleyways leading into Mitre Square. Lavender described the man as of rough and shabby appearance, about 30, 5'7", of medium build, with a fair complexion and a moustache. He was wearing a salt and pepper coloured loose-fitting jacket, a grey peat cloth cap, and a reddish handkerchief knotted around his neck. He had the appearance of being a sailor, but Lavender told police he wouldn't be able to identify him again. He obviously thought the person he saw was less than respectable, as he commented to his friend Harris as they walked past.
"Look here, I don't like going home by myself when I see those characters about."
He said the woman had her hand on the man's chest, but not as if to push him away, and he was taller than her. They were talking quietly and didn't seem to be arguing, but Lavender didn't hear what they said. After he and his friends passed, he didn't look back to see where they went. The murder was mystifying. PC Watkins, who first discovered the body, had gone into Mitre Square on his beat at 1:30 a.m. and had seen nothing unusual. He'd gone to the southwest corner to check that nobody had removed the covers of the coal holes belonging to the buildings in the square, and then shone his bullseye lantern around to the other corners before continuing on his way. So somehow between 1:30 a.m. and 1:44 a.m, when Watkins returned and found the desecrated figure of Catherine Eddowes, the killer had appeared, lured his victim into the square, slit her throat, then carried out his obscene outrages against her corpse, including removing her uterus and left kidney, before disappearing into the night, all in under 15 minutes. In light of our doubt over whether Kate really was a prostitute, it's possible that the killer was someone she knew. Cigarette trader Lavender saw her talking to a man with her hand on his chest. Maybe she was looking for a client, as she and John Kelly were short of money, even if any sex work she engaged in was only casual. Or could she have been approached by a man she knew for some reason? By this time, following the blood-curdling events in Whitechapel over the last few months, women were far more cautious about who they stopped and spoke to in the street so late at night, especially in secluded areas, and police had advised them to travel in pairs where possible. Would Eddowes really have taken the risk of falling foul of the Ripper and stopped to speak to a total stranger at 1 o'clock in the morning? Perhaps she would, if the anti-Semitic propaganda of the time had worked well enough that most people believed the killer was a Jew, leading her to believe that no non-Jew could possibly be dangerous. We'll talk about my theories on this and the profile of the suspect in the final episode. Tension and fear were at an all-time high, and almost 1,000 people descended on Victoria Park to join a demonstration calling for the resignation of the Home Secretary and Police Commissioner Charles Warren. The public had lost faith in their abilities to find the murderer, who was spreading terror unchecked through the East End. There were a series of bizarre but intriguing suggestions of how police could catch the killer, including dressing trained boxers in women's clothes and making them walk the streets to tempt the killer into an attack. Failing this, it was proposed that the police themselves could dress up as ladies. Of course, most police officers at the time had facial hair and had to be over 5'9", so that might have been a giveaway. Sir Charles Warren decided that instead of dressing up, it would be easier to enlist the help of animals. He organised a trial of two bloodhounds named Barnaby and Burgo and put them through their paces in rigorous tests, even giving them his own scent and allowing them to chase him through a public park, something that afforded the press and public much amusement. Unfortunately, as we'll discover next time, Barnaby and Burgo never did get the chance to prove their mettle. The idea of bloodhounds wasn't new. The first recorded case of tracker dogs being used in a homicide investigation was in 1876, when two canines successfully found the missing body parts of dismembered 7-year-old girl, Emily Holland in Blackburn, stuffed up the chimney of a barbershop owned by the killer. Ironically, this murderer became the subject of a gallows ballad when he was hung for the crime. Tragically, it wasn't until 16th of October that Catherine Eddowes' ex-partner Thomas Conway and their three children found out about her death, as they didn't read the papers. Kate was buried in the City of London Cemetery in an unmarked grave, which was finally officially commemorated with a plaque in 1996, 108 years after her death. Less than a month later, the Ripper would steal the life of final canonical victim, Mary Jane Kelly, in a slaying yet more bloody, yet more inconceivably brutal than anything that had been seen so far. Join me again for the penultimate episode of the miniseries as we uncover the heinous, abhorrent details of the climax of the Whitechapel Fiend's Trail of Terror, the coup de grace of the months of hell on earth he had unleashed on the East End. Thank you for listening to part 5 of this Jack the Ripper miniseries. If you enjoyed it, please consider taking the time to leave me a review and feel free to get in touch with any comments or suggestions. Don't forget, if you can't wait for the final two installments, this entire series is already available to my Patreon supporters. So if you'd like to get access, I'll include a link in the show notes. Until next time, take care everyone.